Well, we'll get going. You can see why I pray for rain on days that we have visitors that are as distinguished as Professor Stedman to come and speak to us. It does make a difference, and when it's 60 degrees out and sunny, it makes it really hard. I think, as most of you know, the Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that invites people to come to our meetings for free. We're lucky to be supported by our corporate sponsors, Sea Alaska, the Prospector Hotel, Kensington Core Alaska Mine, the Greens Creek Mine, Alaska Power and Telephone, Alaska Electric Light and Power, Hayton Associates, Wassman and Associates, and GCI. So we certainly thank all of them for their participation. One of the things we've done is advertise this on KTOO and KINY. And usually people hear about it on KTOO, but did anybody hear about this on KINY? Okay. Well, that answers my question there. Thank you. I've had an opportunity to get to know Steve and Stedman a little bit this afternoon, and certainly enjoyed traveling around with them and showing them a little bit of, you know, including the UAS library. Thank you for coming. And Stephen is the deputy director of the Center on Democracy Development Rule of Law at Stanford and a professor of political science at Stanford. He's the former assistant secretary general and special advisor to Kofi Annan at the United Nations. He's the former director of Global Commission on Election Democracy and Security, and he's a resident fellow at Carruthers Hall at Stanford, and he is a former professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and I say that with some pride because I'm a Johns Hopkins alumni. But let's welcome Professor Stephen Stedman.
So I want to say something about what being the resident fellow in Carruthers Hall is. Resident fellows at Stanford are faculty who, with their families, actually live in the student residences. And Carruthers Hall is the largest student undergraduate residence at Stanford, 380 students. My wife and our kids and I live with 380 18 to 22-year-olds. And I say that because everything that I know about peacekeeping, mediation, ethnic conflict, insecurity, all comes from that experience. It's my first time in Alaska, and it's beautiful. Picked a great day for it. It's thrilling to me because that means I've been to 47 of our 50 states, so I only have three more on my list. I've spent the last 15 years thinking about security. What is security? And it turns out it's a more complicated word than you might think. So if you look back historically over time, the earliest mention that we can find is in Cicero. And when he talks about security, it's very much in the sense that we think of an inner calm, an inner confidence, right? Some of the sense that we say, well, that person's very insecure, or that person's very secure. We're talking about a property that they have inside their heads, that they're at ease in their environment. That's what it means to be secure. You're free from fear, right? But somewhere along the line, and we think it's probably in the about 1500, 1600, that meaning shifts from being security as something that you have inside yourself, you feel secure, to something that others provide for you. In Hobbes, for instance, writing in the aftermath of the English Civil War, it's going to be the government that's going to provide you security. You can't make yourself secure. The government is going to provide security for you. At the same time, it turns out the church also had an issue with the idea that somehow we could make ourselves secure. They felt that only God could make you secure, and that security did not come from some internal property that you have, but it's something provided for you, right? And so at that moment, security develops a second meaning. So we have freedom from fear, right? Something that's inside us, and freedom from threat, which is something that somebody outside us is going to provide for us, governments, churches, right? And the problem is these two senses of the word continue up to the present day, and sometimes their senses are in conflict, right? Sometimes governments want to go out of their way, or politicians want to go out of their way to scare you, right, so that you feel fear at a threat that they say they can protect you from, right? Whether, in fact, it's an objective threat to you or not. In fact, a great sociology once wrote that if you actually look at how the state developed in Western Europe, the state was a protection racket. It was constantly getting into wars and getting into fights and then scaring the hell out of their own citizens that only they could protect them from the wars that they were starting, right? This classic protection rat kind of thing. So I want you to keep these things in mind, that security is about freedom from fear and freedom from threat, and that they sometimes don't go together. Just as bad as governments trying to scare you about threats that are non-existent or really not major threats, right, are cases where there are real threats that you should be afraid of, and the government is ignoring, right? Objective threat, no fear, false sense of security, very dangerous. Okay, so I put those things out there to start. Now, One of my jobs at the United Nations was to rethink how the United Nations helped to provide security in the 21st century. And I was brought on, and they gave me a team, and they said, all right, so go make some recommendations as to how we're going to improve international security. I quickly found that there was no consensus about what international security was, and certainly there was no consensus about what the threats to either national security or international security were in the world. So what we found pretty quickly going around the world was, depending on where you live, depending on your wealth, on your level of development, you see a world of different threats. So this was in 2003 to 2005. So when we would go to Washington, D.C. and meet with government people in Washington, D.C., we'd say, what are the great threats to your security? The greatest threat to our security, the Bush administration said, was catastrophic terrorism. Okay? We would go to Africa, and we met with both governments, but we would meet with non-governmental organizations, we'd meet with students, and would ask them, you know, what are the greatest threats to your security? And I can tell you that catastrophic terrorism never came up once, right? Well, what was it? You know, well, there's poverty, you know, grinding poverty. That's the biggest threat to our security. Deadly infectious disease. That's the biggest threat to our security. Bad governance, corruption. That's the biggest threat to our security. Governments wouldn't say that, by the way. Citizens would. So here I am sitting at the United Nations, and we're trying to rethink what collective security would mean, right? Because that's what the United Nations is supposed to be about, collective security. The idea that a threat to one is a threat to all, and if anyone is threatened, then there has to be a response. Made sense in 1945, maybe, when the United Nations was created. But now, how do you make it work when you live in a world where there's no consensus about what the threats are? And so we suggested that maybe we have to, first of all, acknowledge that there are a lot of different threats to security depending on your region and your level of development, and have a new idea that, for instance, the world's response to HIV/AIDS needs to be as robust as our response to international terrorism, right? If we're truly going to have collective security, because we need to address the things that threaten Europe and the United States, and we have to address the things that threaten citizens in Latin America or Africa. So we're trying to get creative in thinking about what collective security would mean. So at the time, we tried to figure out, well, how are we doing? How is the world doing on some of these things, right? Well, it turns out in dealing with terrorism, there was some cooperation amongst governments. There needed to be a lot more cooperation, sharing of information, sharing of financial information so you could go after terrorist assets, right? We were living in a world where everybody was recognizing a problem and then trying to figure out how they could get their, especially their intelligence agencies, to work together, right? Non-proliferation, nuclear non-proliferation, actually pretty good, right? Once you had the NPT, you know, you have 193-odd countries. I think at the time we had 192. You know, small group of them have nuclear weapons. Very little proliferation since the signing of that treaty more than 50 years ago. Okay, that's pretty good. How are we doing about grinding poverty? How are we doing at deadly infectious disease? At the time, we didn't know. In 2003 to 2005, we were in the midst of a revolution in world affairs that was seeing the greatest period, 30-year period, of the reduction of extreme poverty and deadly disease ever in recorded history. We didn't know that. We know it now. So just to throw some good news out at you, because we are so starved for good news, you would think there is no good news in the world if you keep watching presidential debates. But in fact, there is. There is. We reduced extreme poverty by between 60 and 75% in the last 30 years. Staggering. Staggering. Right? And everybody thinks, well, that has to be China. And a good portion of it is China. But it's more than China. It's India, it's Indonesia, Brazil. It turns out you look across the globe, every different region. It was long thought, well, that doesn't include Africa. Right? But the latest research on Africa shows that there's actually been incredible growth over the last 10 years, with the exception of some countries that are still mired in civil war and civil violence, but those are the exceptions now, right? If you look at infant mortality in the world in the last 30 years, dramatic declines in infant mortality, child mortality under 5, maternal mortality. It's actually an amazing achievement. Well, it's an achievement brought about by processes that we only dimly understand, right? Has it been because of international aid, foreign aid? Well, no, not really. I mean, it's not, foreign aid hasn't hurt. It might have helped at the margins. No, it's been about economic growth. Well, where did that economic growth come from? Well, you know, part of the answer is China. You know, what China did over a 30-year period of 8, 9, 10% growth every year, right? Well, that's going to lift a lot of people out of extreme poverty, right? So here's the best bet, is that actually it has to do with globalization. In particular, the incredible explosion in international trade over the last 30 years. Now, if you ever check the statistics on the level of international trade in the world, it started to pick up before World War I, and World War I hammered it. excuse me. That's the hammering World Trade, World War One. In the 1920s, there was an attempt, and you saw again a start, an increase in international trade, right? Devastated by the Great Depression and the 1930s, and then World War II. Steadily, from 1945 onwards, a pretty dramatic growth in international trade. Then you had the end of the Cold War. Then you had a fourfold expansion in international trade since 1990. Fourfold, right? Now, correlation is not causation, but when you see the graphs of international trade and its expansion and the reduction in extreme poverty, it's stunning, right? So the best belief is this mattered. This contributed. This had something to do. Whether it's the whether it's the answer, it was a big part of the answer. So the things that we think of in globalization, openness of borders, openness of movement of people across borders, the ease with which information and finance can move across borders, all those things actually created an incredible economic success story for billions of people in the last 30 years. Now, are there losers to globalization? Yes, there are. The best sort of estimate is that if you actually took the whole world population, globalization had about 1% losers. Just so happens that they're located in Western Europe and in the United States and Canada, and they're called the working class. So one of the great things that trade does is trade creates wealth, right? But if you don't, but it also creates inequality. So if you don't address the inequality, right, trade, unadorned trade, will keep generating wealth, but will keep generating inequality, and eventually, right, will create a backlash against itself. And to the extent that those who are the losers can organize, then it's going to diminish the continuation of trade in the future, right? So where is all this headed, you say? This is supposed to be a talk about global insecurity, right? So I actually think that this is essential to global security. That is, because global security at its heart, right? Now, national security, here, let me give you a little primer. There are all kinds of reference of security, right? The one that we're most common with, the one that grew up out of World War II, is national security, right? That is, what do governments have to do to protect its citizens and its borders, right? And sometimes they say, and our values, right? They will tuck that in there, right? But that's supposed to be what national security is about, right? In the 1990s, there was a counter movement that said, no, security shouldn't be about nations. It should be about people. We should be talking about human security, right? What are we doing to make sure that people are, you know, free from violence in their lives, can live their potentials, they're free from human rights abuses. So all of a sudden, human security became a competitor to national security. All right? But those two, they're really straightforward. Now again, global security. What is global security? What is global security? I puzzle over this. And for 15 years, I've been puzzling over it. So the best that I can put it forward to you is global security is, first of all, the cooperative arrangements, the institutions, the norms that provide regular exchange amongst peoples, amongst governments, that allow cooperation to be extended into all kinds of different problem areas, right? So that when we try to make ourselves secure, we're not doing it at the expense of someone else. but maybe, just maybe, in a way that maximizes their security as we maximize our security. That to me is probably what global security is about. So I think it exists. I think it is based on cooperation. Here's the kicker. It is threatened. Right? Global security is threatened. And it's threatened, as I've already mentioned, by inequality, to the extent that governments in Europe and in the United States don't deal with inequality, you're actually going to threaten global security because you're going to threaten the willingness of governments to cooperate. But it's also threatened by the politics of fear-mongering and the politics that belittles and devalues international cooperation, right? And what is most frightening to me is to witness that in this country over the last year. A politics of naming threats that, to my mind, aren't threats. Muslims aren't threats. Big religion, right? Is terrorism a threat? Yeah, terrorism is a threat, but, you know, it's one that you really want to put into perspective. Right? If you actually think about, at least in this country, you know, the effects in terms of casualties, in terms of, right, economic costs, it's a threat. Is it the great threat of our time? I don't think so. Right? Refugees. All of a sudden, refugees are threats. That's a new one. Right? Refugees are the consequence of conflict and political and religious persecution. How did they all of a sudden become threats? Right? So we have this narrative that's being put over on the American people that there are all these things, there are all these boogeymen out there, and we therefore have to be afraid. And if you're afraid of what I'm telling you, then obviously I'm the only person who can solve the problem. Right? When, in fact, I think there is a really big problem out there. And the big problem is, to the extent that this government, the United States government, and other governments, and our citizens, and citizens elsewhere, start losing confidence in what international cooperation can achieve, when that happens, we're in deep, deep trouble. There is not a single threat to American security that the United States can solve without international cooperation. Name me one. Whatever you think, the great threat to international, the great threat to American national security, you know, how would you solve it without international cooperation? From allies, from international institutions, sometimes even adversaries. So I always say, you know, a good way of thinking about what you really think are the threats to security is, you know, is anything keeping you up at night, and what's keeping you up at night? And for me, I have to say, what keeps me up at night is this mismatch between what we need in this country to be free from threats, right, and the politics of fear that is telling us to be afraid of a whole bunch of things that really aren't the threats, right? Very, very worrisome. Now, I'm going to conclude on this note and then take questions, because I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions ranging from all the different issues that I've raised, the United Nations, what's its role in all of this. But I will stop with this, is that we need a politics in this country that moves from polarization and fear-mongering and paralysis to problem-solving. And the problem-solving has to be about the issues that enable us to lead in getting the cooperation that we need internationally. We need better education. We need more technological development. We need to take care of our infrastructure. There's a whole bunch of things that are real problems, and you have to address inequality. You have to address inequality. It's shocking to me that we have a politics now where in this presidential campaign, there is no candidate who's in favor of free trade right now. The TPP, which Hillary Clinton negotiated, somehow she's abandoned. It's kind of shocking, right? But it's pandering to the American public. It's saying we can't do anything about those who might lose from free trade, and so therefore we're not going to engage in it, and we're going to engage in this politics of pandering, right? And this to me is very worrisome, because the international order that you have and the international cooperation that you have has always been because the United States has been engaged and involved and has been behind creating institutions, norms, and rules that enable governments to cooperate. So I'll end on that note. Thank you.
I'm very interested to know what you think that Jane and Joe Citizen, us here, there, can do to convince the decision makers, whether it's our Congress or whether it's whoever the decisions make, what can we do? We can complain. We can vote the bums out, and some more bums will come in. What can we do?
Mm-hmm. So you can vote the bums out. What would be great is that the bums get voted out for the right reasons, right? Why do we have polarization and paralysis in Congress? Is because Congressmen and women believe that their constituents would rather that they engage in, you know, partisan politics and name-calling and not reaching out to work with their adversaries on the other side than actually getting something done. So if you're a voter and you're a constituent and a citizen, you need to tell your elected representatives that you are sending them to Washington, for instance, not to be to put partisan identity over all else, but rather to solve problems, right? That's what you have to do. You have to solve problems. That would be the first thing that I would say. Yeah. It's a Stanford shirt.
Wonder where I got that. Garage sale, maybe?
Did you live in Crothers?
No. Wilbur.
Okay.
Arroyo.
Okay.
Arroyo Corner, class of 65.
Excellent.
I don't understand why you're shocked by the state of affairs in American politics, given the surfeit of money that's flowing through the system, and the motivations, perhaps, of some of those people who are the sources
yep.
of that money. So what is the spectrum of our options for getting the money out of politics, undoing the effects of Citizens United, if not that itself, and which of those do you recommend?
Yeah, great question. It is true that if you look at where we are in terms of it's been a trend, but it's just reaching shocking levels in this campaign in particular. The small percentage of people who are actually making campaign donations that are in staggering amounts, right? And dwarfing what the other money that's in the system. Now, there's some good news, actually, I think, from this campaign, in the sense that some of the candidates who had the biggest treasure chests pretty much flailed. I mean, Jeb Bush had enormous, enormous money and didn't buy him very many votes, actually. That's a good thing. Well, not a good thing for Jeb Bush, but, you know, it at least indicates that there's something else going on in American politics, that it's still not the case that money will buy you an office. But I agree with you that I think it needs to be addressed precisely because it does give, I think, unequal access of individuals to lawmakers. Lawmakers are going to spend more time with big donors than they are with people who are not donors. I just think that's a fact. It's not corruption. It's the way the system works. They're going to have more access. Lawmakers are going to spend more time raising money instead of doing their job, which is legislating, and that's already happened. It is increasing the perceptions of the American public that we have a corrupt system, and that's corrosive to our democracy. Now, what are you going to do about it? Well, you do have a Supreme Court that, in its last configuration, who knows what's going to happen when you have a new ninth justice, was very aggressive in putting free speech over campaign finance and the good that could come from regulating money. That can change. You can have a new Supreme Court that can change, you know, Citizens United. But what's striking is how many people now say, even if you get rid of Citizens United, money in American politics has become, they like to call it a hydraulic system. You find ways of regulating it here and it comes up here. So it's or whack-a-mole. You hit it here and it comes up here, right? It's extremely difficult to get your hands on it. And what has happened with all of the deregulation of campaign finance is that it's actually taken political power out of the hands of political parties, right? So one idea is, you know, if you really think that political parties are at the base of our democracy, then maybe you actually have to give the political parties a much bigger role in getting the campaign donations and deciding how campaign donations are spent. On the one hand, people react against that and say, well, that doesn't seem democratic to me, but we've never lived in a pure democracy, never. It's not the system that was created. It's all these checks and balances that the founding fathers put into the system that actually were to dilute the strong drink of democracy, right? So we have a system of interest groups. We have a pluralistic system. So can we find a way of which political finance being channeled through political parties actually might be better for aggregating the interests in society than having it just dispersed by all of the individual political action committees and so forth? But it's tough. It is really tough. And on this one, we look bad internationally. We really look bad internationally. Jim mentioned the commission that I directed, where, you know, one of the most important things to having elections with integrity is your ability to control political finance. And we're failing.
Solve the democratic deficit in terms of international affairs, in that it's mostly like elected or experts that aren't elected, like you see in like the WTO. And also, how do you see free trade and regional trade being similar, in that TPP and NAFTA are regional trade agreements, in the future like TPIP is going to be a regional trade agreement? How do you see that as different from free trade in general, especially when we have regional trade agreements that are mostly used to enforce our patent system that adversely affects like generic drug production and like saving lives for malaria in Africa?
Great, great questions. The first one on a democratic deficit, I have to admit that I view it differently, because international organizations are member state organizations. That is, they're created by governments. Governments who are members decide on what the policies of the international organization are, and what they should be doing. You know, 110 member states of the United Nations are electoral democracies, right? So when an ambassador in New York tells somebody in the UN Secretariat that you should do this, to my mind, there's no democratic deficit there. You know, it's a member state organization. The member states are telling a bureaucrat what they're supposed to do, and the bureaucrats are supposed to put that policy into play, and they're held accountable for what the member states want. There's no international bureaucrats are not free agents. Governments watch them really carefully. you know, part of the, like, when I was at the United Nations, there was a very small purview in which my boss, Kofi Annan, could basically try to shame governments into doing something or cajole them into doing something, right? But he did not have the autonomy to wake up one morning and say, the policy of the United Nations is going to be this. He would be out of office the next day. Because, as he said, it's called Secretary General, but let's be clear what the nation states want, right? They want a secretary. They don't want a general, right? They want the first part without the second part. So the deficit for me is, if you want to affect, you know, if you have a problem as a citizen in this country with, let's say, the World Trade Organization, you affect the politics in this country. You tell your representatives in Washington that you have a problem and you don't want Americans supporting this policy that they're pursuing in Geneva, right? Because the World Trade Organization doesn't do it by themselves. It's because member states are telling them what to do. The second one is a great question, and economists really differ on this. Now, one of the reasons that countries have gone to regional trade agreements and regional trade arrangements is because the what's called the Doha Round of the World Trade Organization, the set of negotiations that are supposed to expand the areas for free trade, has been bogged down and has not been able to reach agreement in 20 years. So it's pretty much paralyzed. And so member states, being the creative governments that they are, say, all right, if we can't get what we want through that venue, then what's second best? Well, second best is we can do things regionally. That is, if we can find a group of countries that have similar interests and believe that, coming up with preferential trade agreements and arrangements are going to be beneficial to everybody, then you can pursue it that way. You can also pursue it bilaterally. I mean, in those 20 years that Doha has gone nowhere, I forgot how many bilateral trade agreements the United States is engaged in, but quite a few. Right? And does it all run one way on stuff like patent protection? Well, patent protection is an important part of all of these agreements, because that's an important industry for the United States. There's no question about it. At the same time, in some of these agreements, there are a whole host of different things that are being added. So in TPP, in terms of labor standards, human rights standards that would never have been in former, not a part of WTO kind of arrangements. And the counter argument is, oh, do you really think that Vietnam is going to live up to its agreement concerning human rights or labor standards? And the counter argument is, do you think we have a better chance of them ever adopting these kinds of things if they are successful and grow economically and are part of this club, or if they're not part of the club? Like I said, you can argue it either way. For me, again, going back to the starting point, I actually think amounts of international trade are really important for a whole host of things that we care about. That just the sheer amount of trade matters. But again, that's controversial. There's a Harvard economist, Danny Roderick, who just wrote a book that said, the problem with all the free traders of the last 30 years is that they went too far. And actually that free trade is good, but if they had been a bit more selective, then we wouldn't have the backlash against it that we have. And he may be right. But what I fear now is that the backlash is such that you're not going to see, or at least in our presidential politics right now, you see no champions for it.
Now, this is a kind of a question on misidentified threats. Suppose a tour bus in the Sierras goes off the road, maybe it's or goes over a bridge that's poor infrastructure, goes down a ravine, and lives are lost. Comparatively, if that happens, well, it's a story for 3 days, and then we all move on. Suppose instead a couple who've sworn allegiance to Daesh decide to one day and do actually kill a number, a comparable number of one of the person's coworkers, and we go ballistic. And what can we do in these kinds of situations, or what can policymakers do to kind of manage the situation so we don't go clear down the rabbit hole and maybe carpet bomb Raqqa or do some other silly ass thing?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It goes to the heart of the talk. Again, there are some social scientists out there who love to do this kind of thing where you just tally up fatalities in the United States to due to different causes, bee stings, traffic accidents, getting mauled by, mountain lions, right? And it's funny, all of them outstrip, how many deaths to terrorism, right? The argument in, the problem, and you probably know part of the problem is that a lot of this is fed by media hype and blowing out of proportion individual incidents that when it has something to do with terror, as opposed to, a bus goes off, a shoddily built bridge and kills 24 school children. Or as so many in the Black Lives Matter, movement have said, it's like, politicians go ballistic when it involves terror, and as you say, are they connected to Daesh or this or that? But our political system has an incredible way of just simply registering mass shootings, right, and moving on. Right, you are much greater threat to a random mass shooting than you are to a terrorist shooting in this country. Why isn't that a fear? Well, for some populations it is, but why is that? And it's because I do think citizens matter. I think citizens can engage their elected politicians in discussions about, well, what are the real threats? You keep saying this is the threat, but what about this? This is where people's lives are at stake. This is what, is keeping up people at night. Why aren't you addressing that? I think this is the kind of much more productive dialogue that we could have than in simply judging our politicians by whether they voted a party line or not. Yeah.
Go for it. I was intrigued by your job title, and correct me, it sounded, do you work for the Center for Democracy Development? Is that correct?
No, it's a center at Stanford. It's called the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. Okay. It's a mouthful.
And just the idea about developing democracy that intrigued me, particularly in the light of our present political system, which seems to be, from my humble opinion, encouraging people who are not fit to vote to vote. And so, which is, of course, the weakness of democracy, is that everyone's vote counts, and we have a freedom to have a very, very unrestricted way of choosing who governs us. In light of everything you've been talking about, do you see any areas that we can develop democracy that gives us better outcomes than what we're seeing at the moment?
Well, so when I was on this commission, so this was looking at a very narrow cut of democracy, right? So when I directed this commission, it was on elections, on the integrity of elections. How can you better promote and protect the integrity of elections worldwide? And there's all kinds of reasons to believe that if you improve the integrity of elections, that you actually do get more accountability out of elected officials. And so we were doing this worldwide. So we were studying brand new democracies, brand new, countries trying to transition from authoritarianism, and they're using elections as a means to get there. We're looking at war-torn countries where you're using elections just to figure out who's going to rule, right? So we're looking at every country. And when we issued our report, we actually called out the United States on several different issues having to do with a lack of integrity in our elections. I mentioned one, which is political finance, where we've almost just walked away from the problem. But one is barriers to participation. To the extent that you reduce, the argument goes that actually if you want to deal with polarization, one way of dealing with polarization is actually to increase participation. Part of the problem that we get extreme politics in this country is that in primary elections, very few people vote, and the people who vote tend to be the most committed at the extremes, right? And they're choosing the candidates for the general election, so by the time you get to the general election, your choice is already at the extremes, right? And if it's been gerrymandered, then there is no choice at all. Whoever wins the primary is going to be elected, right? So to the extent that you can actually increase participation, there's at least some thought that this would be a buffer of getting the more extreme committed voters, right? So that's just an idea. Another one has to do with, how legislative districts are drawn. And here you have some experiments in this country where states that have, the referenda process have created, citizen institutions or citizen bodies to do the redistricting instead of trying to take it out of legislature's hands. There might be something in that that's going to improve our democracy, make it more competitive, in fact, because there are so many safe districts in our country now. The problem with that one, though, is that you do run into the fact that there is some sorting that's going on in our democracy where it really does look like people are choosing to move and live amongst people who think like themselves, right? That's a real problem. As somebody said, if you actually tried to make, a competitive election district out of San Francisco, you would have to draw it way out to it would be San Francisco with a thin line going all the way out to Stockton, right? That's what you would have to do to get a competitive, Democratic-Republican competition. And everybody looks at that and says, well, that's farcical. Right, it's farcical. So, yeah, there are some things that can be done, and there are some experiments around them. But let me say, it is worrisome. So when I was in graduate school in the 1980s, there was a professor named Charles Lindbloom, and he said one of the advantage of democracy is that it's better than authoritarianism because we have more information, there's more interaction amongst peoples, and there's more opportunities for debate. And those three things all have the potential to change people's minds. And for democracy to work, citizens have to be willing to change their minds. If they're persuaded otherwise, they have to be able to change their minds. That's how you rule. You govern through persuasion, right? And if you think about changes in our country in terms of technology, in terms of media, and the sorting that I was talking about, many of these things run against these three things, right? We have more information than ever, yes, but it's very clear that so many of us are choosing information that supports our pre-existing beliefs. We're not looking for information that challenges our beliefs. We're looking for information that supports our beliefs, right? Interaction, I already mentioned, you know, that we have a lot of sorting where people no longer are interacting with people who think differently than themselves, right? Or come from a different slice of life, right? So we're losing our ability to get perspectives outside of a small circle of friends and acquaintances, right? And then debate has become shouting. Heaven help us if we have to have any more debates in this primary season. I mean, my goodness, it's just, it's amazing that people still watch. But all these things are working against our ability to solve problems, to change people's minds so that governments can say, all right, enough people have changed their mind that we can all agree that this is good. Not everybody, but enough people have agreed that we can do something.
Thank you. I'm very impressed with the breadth of your knowledge. There were two problems that you didn't mention at the start about security, global security. One is climate change, and the other is now the buzzword is Zika. Is there Ebola?
Yes.
There was HIV, et cetera. Put those in context, and should we not be afraid of those, or what are the governments of the world doing about them?
That's a great question, and I think both of them, but deadly infectious disease and new deadly infectious diseases like Zika are a threat to our security, right? But they require a very measured response. Climate change, I believe, is a threat to our security in all kinds of different ways. That, to me, it's for too long in this country, it's been of the character of objective threat of which we're not going to address because it's false security. That's where we are, false security involving that. But let me say something about the deadly infectious disease example. There are, again, ways in which politicians can engage in the politics of fear-mongering that are antithetical to getting the kinds of international cooperation that you need to solve the problem. Ebola was a great example. When you had the Ebola... So just to put this in context, the Ebola outbreak that happened in West Africa was either the 24th or 25th outbreak of Ebola in Africa in the last 20 years. Every single one before them had been staunched because of excellent international cooperation, rapid action, right? And I think that's what shocked so many people was that cooperation failed, right? That WHO didn't do the right things or they just couldn't get a handle on it. But when it took off and when it started to, where the numbers started to rise and people feared this is going to be exponential and it's going to be, this is going to be crazy in terms of the numbers of infected and dead. American politicians, where the threat of Ebola in the United States was, pretty damn minimal, right, and easily manageable, chose to choose the politics of fear-mongering, many of them. And in ways that, again, when President Obama said, well, actually, this is a problem for international security. We're going to use the U.S. military. We're going to deploy 3,000 soldiers to Liberia. They're going to have all of this medical equipment. They're going to have all this stuff. Certain members on Capitol Hill chose to play the politics of fear within the United States and said, how dare he? How dare he prioritize saving Liberian lives, right, when the threat could be here? And the answer from the administration was, because if we stop it in Liberia, it will never get here, right? So, and the same with Zika right now. Congress has not, there's been a request, a funding request in front of Congress now for, I think, a month, and they haven't acted on it yet. The House has not acted on it. And to my mind, they're, you know, this is really playing with fire, because there's an enormous amount of travel, I'll tell you, between Brazil and the United States, between Central America and the United States. Right? A lot of mosquitoes, too, here, right? It will not take a lot to set this off. This is not Ebola. This is actually much more of a threat to the United States than Ebola was in terms of, you know, infection. And the willingness of people on the Hill just to, like, not our problem, or, you know, who cares, is pretty shocking, I think. Any more? Going to go around to the mic?
Two things. Number one, he'd also asked about climate change, which yes. I thought was a good point that would be answered. And the second question I'd have is there any correlation between the lack of support for international institutions at the end of World War I in this country and the growing lack of support for international institutions now?
Wow. So on the first one, you know, as I said, climate change is a real threat. You'll find no shortage of people at the Pentagon to discuss climate change as a threat to national security. I mean, every year they go up to Capitol Hill and tell Congress why climate change is actually a threat to national security. But you first of all have to believe that there is such a thing as global warming, and if you don't believe it, then it's just in one ear out the other, right? The isolation question and international organizations. So I think the 1920s, it was a bit more complicated. In the 1920s, people like to say, well, you know, when the United States refused to join the League of Nations, this pretty much set Europe down the path that conflict would once again be inevitable, and it would just be, you know, a hiatus between one war and the next war. That if the League was going to work, it really had to have United States involvement. And I think there is something to that, but I think more importantly, there's been some great recent work. Terrific book by a guy named Adam Tooze, who's a historian at Columbia, who wrote a book called The Deluge, which actually is relevant to our time in a different way, so bear with me. So what Adam's book is about is, he said, in the 1920s, right, the real challenge for France and Great Britain and the United States was to figure out a way that they were going to cooperate economically, to cooperate financially and economically in ways that were going to support, right, a resurrection of the European economy and rebuilding of Europe in the 1920s in a way that would support, like, the democratic experiment in Weimar Germany, right? That was the real, that was the issue. League of Nations, that was good, that was out there. It's kind of abstract, right? It's only going to come into play if things get bad. But his point was, well, how is it going to get bad? It was going to get bad if you failed on economic cooperation, right? If it became beggar your neighbor economics, and you became one against the other, right, in dealing with economic shocks and recession and then the Great Depression, then you were going to have real trouble. And that's where they failed. They didn't understand the relationship between economics and security, right? They thought these were separate domains when, in fact, they are really intertwined. And that's part of what I'm trying to get across tonight. We think of these things as separate domains, but our success in terms of building international economic cooperation, right, is essential for our security and international security. And they didn't understand that at the time, and that's where they failed. So I think there are some lessons that you could draw, probably different from the ones where you were going. But.
Yeah, those are good. Okay. Any more questions? Yes, Jim.
Much of the mischief of history, I think, has been caused by people who think they are exceptional, that God is on their side, for example. So talk about American exceptionalism and whether that is a fundamental problem for us by which we overreact with a sense of fear and insecurity from the inside, as you talked about at first. And what should we do about that? Is that something we need to shuck off like an old shawl before we can get back to the business of global security?
Wow. These are not easy questions. So American exceptionalism, there's two parts of what it means to be exceptional, right? What is, you can look at it objectively, right? And certainly at the end of the Cold War, for a brief time, 10, 15 years, the amount of power, relative power that we had was truly exceptional, right? Our situation after World War II, right, because we didn't have the destruction that Europe went through, that Asia went through, right, did put us in somewhat of an exceptional position, just in terms of capacity, right, and power. But then when you get to the 1990s and the end of the Cold War, where there's that period of about 15 years, really up to the Gulf War, where, we're described, the French described us as the hyperpower, not just superpower, but the hyperpower, right? And I think there was something that was corrupting about that. What was corrupting about it was a sense that we have so much power that we can just unilaterally decide what we're going to do. We don't have to consult, right? If we want to do something, we'll do it. People think this was only George W. Bush, but there were lots of examples in the Clinton administration that were very similar. But really, the biggest example, of course, was the decision to go to war in Iraq in 2003. And what was shocking to somebody like Brent Scowcroft, who national security advisor under George Bush Sr., was that we had so much hubris that, heck with the United Nations, we didn't even have NATO on board. We couldn't convince some of our closest allies to go to war, but we went to war. Right? That does suggest an enormous amount of hubris coming from a position of we have so much power, we could decide what we're going to do. Now, there's the other connotation of American exceptionalism, which is one that tends to be values-based, that so much of history that has affected elsewhere has not affected us. We haven't been corrupted by a lot of bad ideas in the world. In fact, we are the shining, you know, the example on the shining hill. And that, therefore, entitles us. It gives a sense of entitlement about what to do internationally. Sometimes, if you have very good politicians and very good leaders, they can channel that in pretty amazing, productive ways. Witness FDR and the creation of the Bretton Woods Institutes and the United Nations in the aftermath of World War II, right? But yes, it has also potential seeds of disaster and in there, because again, you feel that there's some kind of God-given entitlement that you are not going to be victim of the same mistakes as others, right? Both of these things do tend to hubris.
So you talk about polarization as though it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not happy seeing the Congress not getting anything done, but I would like to see them get some things done, but I would like them to be the right things. I don't want to see the minority standing around wringing its feckless hands while the majority gives, you know, $85 gazillion to the military-industrial complex and throws everyone, male under 25 and of color, in jail. So what I see is that 30 years ago, the brand D wing of the political establishment abandoned its principles and moved towards what I guess is now is being called in the Facebook world neoliberalism. I guess that's a word that exists. I wasn't aware about it, but they've kind of abandoned the idea of the social contract. And so for those of us on the left, there's no champion anymore. Mm-hmm. And so how, other than by getting people mad as heck and refusing to go along with it, how can we get a broader political spectrum? How can we get the debate to encompass that rather than just allowing the people who talk the loudest to move us ever so slowly to, you know, ratcheting really to the right as has been happening over the last three decades?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question because, you know, if we had gone back to the 1970s, there was an enormous amount of disaffection with American democracy because many thought there was no alternative between the right, you know, the Republicans and Democrats really didn't provide much of an alternative, right? So now we're cursed. There is an alternative, right? But it is an alternative that again has become mired in a politics and a bending of rules that doesn't produce legislation, it doesn't produce action in Washington. And here's the kicker, of course, is that if the status quo prevails, right, who wins? Most people would say, well, conservatives and Republicans who do not want change tend to value the status quo much more than Democrats do, right? So we already have a status quo bias, and the effect of this polarization is actually to reinforce the status quo bias. There's a lot of discussion amongst American political scientists about, are the different parties to blame equally for the situation that we're in? There are those who write and say, sort of a pox on both parties. Democrats are as extreme as the Republicans have become extreme. And then you have people like Mann and Ornstein. What is it? It's even worse than it looks. It's a small book. It's actually a fun book. You should read it. But they're all turning a different. And for them, it's like actually it's an asymmetric problem that. The Democrats actually haven't become more to the left. Democrats are pretty much where they've been, certainly for the last 25 years. But there's been a real shift in the Republican Party becoming further to the right and to the extreme. So that somebody like Bob Dole now looks and says, I would not fit in this. Where would I fit in this party? Right? Well, he would be the furthest to the left in terms of sitting senators on the Republican side right now, if he were in office. And so for them, it's, you know, there's a particular problem here, and it's asymmetrical. We had Olympia Snowe to Stanford a couple of years ago. It was when she decided that she was going to give up being a senator. She'd had enough. It was driving her crazy. And we talked for an hour about potential reforms that you could do, because there's a long list of reforms that you could carry out to try to improve our democracy. And I asked her at the end, I said, all right, tell me your gut feeling on this. What do you think would have to happen to have more impact? We do all these reforms, or moderate Republicans seize back their party from the extremes? Oh, well, that's easy. It's like moderate Republicans have to seize back their country from the extremes, right? So forget all the reforms. If we could just do that, then we could have a functioning politics in Washington. So even on this question of, is this symmetrical, right, or is it asymmetrical? Is one party to blame more than others? There's differences. There are some who feel polarization is not the problem per se, as you suggest. We want a choice, but how do you get the choice without the dysfunction, right? Real problems. All I can say is, since my colleagues in American politics haven't solved this, I don't have good answers for you. When they figure it out, I'll let you know.
Well, listen, thank you very much.
Thanks.